Wednesday, January 8, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. On Monday, a federal judge in Philadelphia sentenced a woman known as Jihad Jane to 10 years in prison for a foiled plot to assassinate a Swedish cartoonist, a cartoonist who had offended Muslims by depicting the Prophet Muhammad in a cartoon. The story is itself very interesting, coming at the intersection of gender, the war on terror, and Islam. And it has everything to do with the recruitment of terrorists, with the involvement of terrorists in the United States, and with the very idea of offense. Offense in terms of the offense taken by Muslims to the cartoon that will lead to the attempted assassination of a cartoonist in Sweden. Ashby Jones of the Wall Street Journal reports, Colleen LaRose, 50 years old, pleaded guilty in 2011 to four charges related to giving aid to terrorists. She faced a maximum sentence of life in prison, but she received far less after federal prosecutors asked the judge to take into consideration that she had cooperated extensively with prosecutors. Her offense goes back to 2008, and as she told those at her trial, she had been recruited over the internet by jihadists. As an American woman, she was recruited because of her American Western appearance that would allow her to blend into Swedish society. She took offense at what she saw on the internet as the mistreatment of Palestinians, and she decided to become a jihadist. She made contact with jihadi elements, and she was actively recruited. But when she went to Europe, she became frustrated that her handlers appeared to be somewhat reluctant to go through with the plan. The plan was, quite specifically, a plot to kill a Swedish cartoonist named Lars Vilks. His depiction of the Prophet Muhammad had enraged Muslims in many lands, and there were open calls for his assassination. This trial also tells us something about the slow process of justice. This plot goes back to 2008. Ms. LaRose went to Europe in 2009 in order to conduct the assassination. She pleaded guilty to the counts in 2011. And if you're keeping track of the calendar, she was sentenced just a matter of days ago, in 2014. Again, this particular case comes at the intersection of the war on terror and the mobilization of terrorists, even in the United States, and the reality of Islam. At least we must note the reality of Islamic elements who are quite ready to militarize terrorists from virtually any constituency, including, as this case makes very clear, Western women, even women in the United States. The reality is that intelligence agencies are very aware of the fact that Islamic elements are radicalizing youth in Spain, in Germany, in the Netherlands, in Great Britain, and in the United States, as well as elsewhere. As a matter of fact, yesterday's edition of the Wall Street Journal pointed to the fact that Germany is considering adding Islam to its state curriculum in order to try to stem losses to jihadists of young Muslims who were born in Germany but have grown disaffected with German and European society and have gone to various places in the Islamic world to wage holy war. It is absolutely astounding to imagine what we're looking at here in terms of the recruitment of an American woman and the very successful radicalization of that woman in order to deploy her as a murderess, an assassin. But if that sentence handed down on Monday points to a case that is itself shocking, it pales in significance to the case that was revealed yesterday, when CNN and other worldwide media reported that a 10-year-old girl in Afghanistan alleged that she was pressured to carry out a would-be suicide bombing on a border police station in the southern Afghanistan province of Helmand. As CNN reports, there were conflicting reports about how the plot was foiled, but the fact that a young girl was caught up in the middle of it was shocking enough that Afghan President Hamid Karzai quickly condemned the alleged attackers. Last year, CNN notes, Afghan police intercepted 41 children whom insurgents were planning to use as suicide bombers. They were between the ages of 6 and 11 years old. This little 10-year-old girl, who has since been returned to her family, was radicalized by her own brother, identified as an Al-Qaeda operative. She was asked to cross the river across from this border crossing, and she was asked then to go to the river in order to cross it wearing a bomb, which she was to detonate on the troops that were stationed there. However, when she got into the water, she panicked, and the boy, her older brother who had the bomb, ran, and the girl herself went to police. She told police and authorities that she had been recruited by her brother for this bombing, but she was not told that it was a suicide bombing. It was unclear as to whether or not, at age 10, she had figured that out. She had been told by her older brother and others that her action would lead to the death of soldiers, but not to herself. Let me repeat once again the CNN report that Afghan forces have stemmed the attempted use of children between the ages of 6 and 11 as suicide bombers. So here in the course of about 48 hours, in a federal courtroom in Philadelphia and in the Helmand province of Afghanistan, we have very clear evidence of the fact that when a society turns in this direction, no one is safe, not even 6-year-old girls. And what we're looking at here, of course, is the radicalization that is mobilized by offense. Islam is a religion of offense. It takes offense. Blasphemy is a crime worthy of death. And one of the things we must keep in mind as Christians is that Christianity is not, in contrast to Islam, an honor religion. Our Lord Jesus Christ himself took on dishonor in our place. He did not ask his disciples to protect his honor. When he is blasphemed, when he is denied, when he is rejected, he calls upon his disciples to evangelize, not to take militant terrorist action. From a worldview perspective, one of the things we must do in a situation like this is reverse engineer the worldview. What worldview would allow for the use of suicide bombing? What worldview would allow for the use of children as suicide bombers? What worldview would allow for the use of this 10-year-old girl recruited by her own brother for a suicide bombing mission? If you reverse engineer that worldview, you come up with a reality that points to the fact that that worldview comprehensively is based upon something that is anti-life, anti-human, and inherently violent. You reverse engineer that worldview, and it explains a great deal about what's going on in Afghanistan and in so many other parts of the world. But as that courtroom in Philadelphia on Monday reminds us, we don't have to look all the way to Afghanistan to find that worldview in operation. Over the course of the 20th century, the worldview of evolution was supposed to replace the worldview of Christianity, at least to displace Christianity in the biblical worldview, in terms of the account of the origin of the cosmos and of humanity that is held by most people. And to the frustration of many in the cognitive elites, that simply has not happened. Survey after survey indicates that though Darwinism and evolution in general has made vast inroads into American academia and the worldview of the American elites, at the grassroots level, Americans routinely deny and reject evolution as a plausible rationale for how human beings in particular came to exist and how the cosmos in general came to be. This is to the enormous frustration of many of the opinion shapers in this country. And that became particularly evident last week when the Pew Research Center's Religion and Public Life Project released data indicating that those who identify as Republicans in their surveys in America are less likely now to affirm evolution than they were even back in 2009. Now, the use of the designation Republican here just has to do with the way the question was asked. A closer look at the data would indicate that the vast number of Americans actually reject evolution, at least when it comes to explaining humanity and human origins. Furthermore, the shift on evolution is frustrating the cognitive elites and the influence makers in this country because it's running, as they would see it, precisely in the wrong direction. That point was made abundantly clear in a column that appeared in Saturday's edition of the New York Times by Charles Blow. He writes, quote, "In 2009, the gap between the share of Republicans and Democrats who believed in evolution was just 10 percentage points, 54% and 64% respectively. Last year, that gap widened to a whopping 24 points because of the percentage of Democrats who believed in evolution inched up to 67%. The percentage of Republicans believing so plummeted to 43%. Now, more Republicans believe that, quoting, humans and other living things have existed in their present form since the end of time, end quote, than believe in evolution." So wrote Charles Blow. He then writes, "This sad news comes via a survey released this week by the Pew Research Center's Religion and Public Life Project. In fact," he says, "this isn't only sad, it's embarrassing." Well, let's look at the data a little more closely. After all, he appears to be very proud of the Democrats for affirming evolution, but it turns out that over 30% of Democrats also reject the theory. When it comes to Republicans, the fact that only 43% affirm evolution is, so far as Mr. Blow is concerned, a national crisis, a deep embarrassment. He then writes this absolutely amazing paragraph, quote, "I don't personally have a problem with religious faith, even in the extreme, as long as it doesn't supersede science and it's not used to impose outdated mores on others," end quote. Well, that's quite a paragraph. Let's look at it more closely. He says he doesn't personally have a problem with religious faith. A very interesting way to put the assertion in the first place. He then says, even in the extreme. Well, what in the world is that supposed to mean? We can presume it means something like Orthodox biblical Christianity. What else could he possibly mean there? Then he says, as long as it doesn't supersede science. Well, there you have it. There you have the cognitive elite saying very clearly, science is supreme. Everything else has to bend to science. Science determines the reality. But the other thing we have to keep in mind here is that science isn't a singular, unitary thing. What science is he talking about? What particular theory of evolution is he talking about? His own paper routinely, very sequentially, tends to run articles about major changes in evolutionary theory. What science is he talking about? Well, he's talking about the dominant understanding of science that is held by the opinion makers of this country. And it must reign supreme. Everything must bow to it, even religious faith. Or, as he says, religious faith, even in the extreme. The second thing he said was that he doesn't have a problem with religion so long as it's not used to impose outdated mores on others. In other words, just keep your religion out of the public square and public policy when it comes to any kind of debate on morality. At least he didn't try to argue that we shouldn't legislate morality. He understands that all legislation is moral in one way or another. He understands that every society legislates morality. He must understand that. He just wants to be absolutely sure that no one's religion, especially extreme religion, has a shaping influence on those sexual mores. One of the other things we must keep in mind is that the increased secularization of American society is disproportionate in the electorate. It is far more characteristic of Democrats, who are far more likely to register as nones, that is, no religious preference or affiliation, than are Republicans, who are far more likely to identify as Christians, in particular, as evangelical Christians. But Mr. Blow isn't finished with his analysis. We don't have to wonder who is in the target of his concern. He identifies evangelical Christians explicitly. He writes, "When you look at white evangelical Protestants, the evolution denialism gets even worse. Only 27% of that group believes in evolution. According to a 2011 Pew report, while white evangelical Protestants make up only 18% of the population overall, they make up 43% of Republicans who fall into the category of staunch conservatives." End quote. So before we had extreme religion, now we have staunch conservatives, and we have evangelical Christians explicitly mentioned as the problem, part of the national embarrassment he writes about. But he also sees a political agenda behind the theological agenda. He writes, quote, "But I believe that something else is also at play here, something more cynical. I believe this is a natural result of a long-running ploy by Republican Party leaders to play on the most base convictions of conservative voters in order to solidify their support. Convince people," he writes, "that they're fighting a religious war for religious freedom, a war in which passion and devotion are one's weapons against doubt and confusion, and you make loyal soldiers." End quote. Well, let's put a couple of things here on the record. Number one, all political parties, every political party, will use religion to its advantage whenever it can. In a fallen world, we had just better expect that. And it's going to happen on the left, on the right, it will happen among Democrats and Republicans and every political party in between. Might it be true that the Republican Party or Republican Party strategists would strategize to use evangelical conviction to the benefit of the party? You bet. But honestly, is that an adequate explanation for what we're looking at here? Not hardly. Those who deny evolution as an adequate explanation for the cosmos and for humanity in this survey were not doing so in order to prove themselves good Republicans, but rather they were doing so out of deep worldview commitments, or at least out of an instinctive worldview commitment that finds resonance in the Bible's explanation of origins rather than in that of the dominant evolutionary theory. The second thing we must keep in mind is that evolution, as an ideological principle, is absolutely central to the liberal progressive project of replacing the Christian worldview and Christian morality with a different set of moral and cultural principles. In other words, a different worldview. Richard Dawkins, perhaps the most famous evolutionist alive, famously said that the doctrine of evolution, in particular Darwinism, made it possible to become an intellectually fulfilled atheist. Using that in the current context, you might say that Darwinism allows one to be an intellectually fulfilled secularist, moving morality and the culture in the direction of a secular ethic. As it turns out, the Pew data reveal that millions of Americans aren't going along with that project. And that fact leads some, including Charles Blow, and no doubt many of his colleagues in the national media elite, to be deeply embarrassed for the entire nation. But after reading this column, and reading it very carefully, I don't think it's the nation that needs to be embarrassed. Finally, there has been a great deal of attention in recent days to a very sad story that began in California and has now moved to Texas. It is the case of a 13-year-old girl, Jahi McMath, who went into the hospital for a tonsillectomy and ended up, through surgical complications, being declared legally dead, indeed brain dead, leading to a controversy between health authorities and the hospital on the one side and her parents on the other side. As the Associated Press reports, the hospital there in Oakland had argued since before Christmas that Jahi's brain death means she is legally dead and she should be disconnected from the ventilator that has kept her heart pumping for the last now over 4 weeks. However, the girl's mother has refused to accept the fact that the girl is dead, pointing to the fact that her heart is beating. And now, the girl, through a very complicated legal maneuver, has been moved to a facility in Texas on the singular authority of her mother, and with medical authorities saying that what happened was the removal of a corpse, not of a patient. From a Christian worldview perspective, this is an excruciatingly difficult situation. Brain death is itself medically complicated and not without its severe critics. And yet, when it comes during our day of high technology to defining death, it's hard to come up with something other than brain death that actually identifies the point at which natural death occurs in a human body. Medical authorities have pointed to the fact that not one single person yet declared brain dead has come back to life. And when it comes to the situation of this 13-year-old girl, we can certainly understand the plight of her parents, and we can also understand their very natural suspicion that there are those who would define death in ways that are not true to a biblical or Christian worldview. This situation is so complex, morally and medically, that it would take an extended analysis to try to determine exactly what issues are at stake and what direction would be right. But let's remember the fact that the Christian worldview reminds us that death is to be opposed and never to be embraced. But we also are informed by Scripture that death is a reality, a tragic reality that one day will come for every single one of us. And we also need to recognize that in this day of incredible medical technology, defining the exact point of death, one that fits with a Christian worldview, is very difficult. One of the concerns about the use of brain death as this category is that it could allow for doctors to declare someone brain dead in order to harvest organs. This is not just a hypothetical reality. There are very important medical ethicists who have warned about this. But at the same time, it's also a reality that no one at this point who has been declared brain dead has ever returned to life. At this point, it is very unclear where the story goes and what will happen with this young girl and with her family. But as we pray for her family, we must also keep in mind that one day, virtually every family will be faced with a very similar, if not identical, situation. The time to think about the meaning of life and death is now, not delaying until the moment of extreme crisis. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/albertmoeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.